Okay, welcome to another morning Dharma talk at this retreat. Yesterday I was talking about some of the hindrances which happen in meditation. I want to continue on that subject and bring in later on some of the standard teachings of Buddhism to try and tie meditation to just the Dharma in such a way that it gives you a deeper meaning in what's happening and why it's happening. Traditionally, when we talk about hindrances, you all know the five hindrances, which is a very nice way of looking at the things which stop you becoming peaceful in meditation. And you probably know those hindrances by heart. They're called niwarana, which literally means like closing the door. The opposite is viwarana, which is what you do to open a door. But when you close the door, when you open your door, you must always do it mindfully, otherwise it makes a noise. So please keep careful when you open the doors and close the doors in these rooms. All it needs is just a little bit of patience. So you don't allow the automatic door to make a noise. You just stay for a little while and just put your hand in there so it closes gently and softly. But the closing of the doors, which close you from attaining these beautiful deep states of meditation, just to emphasize the point that the still states of meditation are no different than the insight which comes from those deep states, the Buddha called these hindrances the hindrances which not only block peace, but also prevent wisdom from arising. The obstacles to both peace and wisdom. It's just a single path. What blocks one blocks the other. What frees one frees the other. So once those hindrances are abandoned, then you're not just available to gain deep insights, you're also open to achieve these deep states of meditation called the jhanas. In fact, in one of the most profound sutras, profound not in the way it's explained, but in profound in its consequences, is the Nalakapana Sutta, which monks quote a lot, which says, without the jhanas, without the stages of deep meditation, these hindrances invade the mind and remain. But having attained or got into these jhanas, the hindrances don't invade the mind and remain. It's as simple as that. One of the main purposes of a still mind is to overcome these hindrances and keep them out for a long time. And it should be quite clear when you explain what those hindrances are. Just the first two, just desire and ill will. I've already been emphasizing through this whole retreat so far that we try to let go of desire, let go of controlling, let go of trying to make things happen. And also we're trying to be kind and be gentle, which is opposite of ill will. And so just by those attitudes, which I emphasized from the very beginning, making peace is what overcomes the desire. And being kind and being gentle overcomes the ill will. And through those attitudes of mind, you are undermining the hindrances. And because you are taking away the source of those hindrances, their ground, they're just the hindrances can't last. Those first two hindrances of desire and ill will are overcome with your right attitude. Unfortunately, that many people look at things like hindrances and think you can overcome desire, by wanting to get rid of desire. Or you can overcome desire by ill will, by hating it. Or the opposite, you can overcome ill will by being angry at anger. And you can see, just with a tiny bit of logic, that if you try and overcome those hindrances through force, you're just actually adding to them. Which is the experience of many meditators. They try so hard, and they investigate so much time and energy trying to calm their mind, they just get frustrated. It's not they can't do it, it's just they're not seeing how it's done. And the Buddha was very clear, and sometimes it just needs to be emphasized what the Buddha actually said. You know, to make peace, be kind, be gentle. And I've mentioned that's the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention, Sammasankappa. And check it out if you like. This is the right intention, the attitude, if you like, with which we meditate. And if you do things like that, you find the hindrances are overcome because you're making peace. Making peace means you're accepting things. You're not making a war with things. So you've got a tired mind. You've got a sick mind. You've got a crazy family. You've got a sort of a stupid monk. you've got sleepy mind, you've got sort of water welling up in your toilets and having all the shit come out of the bottom. Whatever it is which is happening, you can make peace with it. It's amazing just what you can make peace with in life. And sometimes you see people in enormous pain and they find they can just make peace with it. And doctors are quite surprised. Why is it there is a person who should be screaming in agony and they're just so at peace with things? And it's amazing just what you can make peace with in this world. Even some people who've had the misfortune to be in torture camps and who've been sort of subjected to horrendous pain and treatment, still that some of these people can actually make peace with this. And it's amazing when they report just what's possible with a mind which is has the right attitude. They can't fight that pain with willpower, but they can certainly make peace with it with willpower. So it's amazing what you can do. So if people can do that in such extreme situations, surely we can make peace with the little irritations of life, and thereby we overcome this desire, this craving, this wanting, which is the first of the hindrances. And the reason why the Buddha put that number one on the hindrances, because that is number one as the biggest source of problems. And as a check for you, please remember that that craving is also the cause of suffering, of the second noble truth. And so if you're ever disappointed in your meditation, if you're ever frustrated, if you're ever suffering at any moment on this retreat, please remember, it's not the retreat center, it's not the teacher, it's not the food, it's not the bed, it's the craving. It's the wanting. The wanting is the cause of suffering and nothing else. It's not your inability or your stupidity or the fact that you're just a novice meditator or that you're old or you're young or you're Asian or you're Caucasian. We're all Asians anyway. It doesn't matter. The cause of suffering is craving. So if you're not having a good time, if you're tense, if you're restless, and there's craving there somewhere, check it out. It's a hindrance. And you overcome that just by making peace. And as I say, with the ill will, it's amazing just the ill will which people develop in a meditation retreat. You're with the cream of people here. The very fact that, you know, you're keeping 8 precepts and you're devoting 9 days of your life to meditation and you're with these great monks and great nuns, the very fact you're here means that you're the cream of the crop of humanity. You're the highest. And if you can't have a sense of peace with people here, where can you have peace? Because out there in the world, people are far more selfish. And their ethics and their aspirations are far lower than yours. So how can you have ill will to the people here? There was a retreat which I gave years ago over in the east of Australia. And there was in this retreat, there was one man who was always making such a noise. Now his breathing was just so loud all day when he was meditating. And that really disturbed a lot of people. So much so that in the question time, there's a piece of paper and say, "Ajahn Brahm, can you please ask some people to breathe quietly?" They had so much ill will towards this man. And then I sort of told them that this fellow has cancer of his sinus. He's only got a couple of months to live. This is his last throw of the dice to try and recover from this illness. Everything else has failed. He simply can't breathe through his nose. And as soon as I said that, all their ill will turned to compassion. No one complained at all. And they felt so much sympathy and empathy that there was a fellow, almost about to die, who was actually trying to meditate and do something in his last months of life. So much ill will comes when we don't understand. As a postscript to that, I met him many years later. He got a full recovery. And now he's going around teaching meditation. A great guy. And then he came to see me and said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "No." He said, "No, I expect you don't remember me because you expect me to be dead, but I'm not." So here I am. And he told me about the retreat and how much it helps. Another interesting part of that story, that on that retreat, just the last day, he told me this in an interview the very last day, He said he was meditating there, the usual, because his whole nose was blocked with a tumour. And then he said he suddenly, his eyes were closed, he heard a pop in his brain. And he could breathe through his nose. He said somehow or other that tumour shrunk, or disappeared, really for a few seconds, but then it closed up again, and he couldn't breathe again. But he says it was a very, very weird experience. There he was for 8 days, not being able to breathe through his nose at all. And he relaxed so much, and he could breathe. The tumour had shrunk, just right there and then, he could see it, because he could breathe, but then it closed up again. It must have opened up again later on, because he survived. So that's actually what happens when we meditate. If you make your mind very peaceful and still, you don't expect anything, you don't want anything, then when those hindrances are overcome, then beautiful things can happen. Not just still states of mind, not just great insights, but even great boosts to your health. That's one story amongst many. But the main reason I told that story is we should not really have ill will to our fellow meditators. So please don't have ill will towards me telling the stories over and over again, which you hear every retreat. Because it's only a certain amount of stories which any monk has in life. There's only a certain number of ways you can teach the Dhamma. So if you repeat yourself, look, you know, I've got to say something, so give us a break. And also the most important, give yourself a break as well, because it's amazing how many people have ill will towards themselves on a retreat. You know, sometimes you've been coming here and meditating for such a long time and you still haven't got, you know, anywhere in the meditation. You go and beat up on yourself, stupid me, I'm a hopeless meditator, I should do better than this. And you get upset and you'll have ill will towards yourself. And that ill will towards yourself is so common. But many of you can't see it. There's an ill will which is just below the reach of your radar. Which is why one of the skillful methods in meditation, if you're coming across any blockage in your meditation, you get into this state, you just can't get further, you can't get deeper. One of the first things I would recommend you to do is give some loving kindness to yourself. I say that because it's worked so many times. People think, I've got no ill will towards myself, I love myself. Yeah, sure. But they give a little bit of loving kindness to themselves at that blockage in the meditation and they get deeper immediately. What it's shown is they did have some ill will towards themselves and they never noticed it. And again, one of the reasons you don't notice it is because it's been there all your life. It's something you've taken for granted. You just don't know what's always been there. So you give that tiny bit of loving kindness towards yourself and the blockage is taken away. Ill will is almost invisible for some of you. So don't think, I can't see any ill will, I like myself. Try a bit of metta towards yourself and you'll be surprised at how that clears the blockage, the hindrance in your meditation. Then you've got such things like sloth and torpor, which is one of my favourite hindrances. Because with sloth and torpor, you're meditating such a lot here, there'll be times when you get bored and when you get dull. So if it's physical dullness, that's why I say sleep. But if it's mental dullness, then play. Play around with your mind. Which is why that when people get bored in meditation, I say, well, change it around a bit. Have a bit of fun in games. Which is why I developed the backwards breathing meditation. And there's no other monk or nun, I think, in the history of Buddhism, has developed this backwards breathing. I've got a patent on this. It's an Ajahn Brahm invention. And if you want to know what backwards breathing meditation is, you know, you ask a person, I'll do it now, do this exercise. Close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and then open your eyes. Just 3 times, don't fall asleep after 2. And then open your eyes, after the 3rd breath. And that's the ordinary breathing. Backwards breathing is, now close your eyes, breathe out first and then in. Out and then in. Out and then in. Three times. You'll find it actually is different. It should be the same. But if you start with the out breath and then the in breath and then the out and in breath, it's actually different. So that's called backwards breathing meditation. It's not in, out, in, out. It's out, in, out, in, out, in. It's just playing around with our perceptions, just the way we look at things. Because we always, when you ask a person to breathe in and out three times, it's always you start on the in-breath. So let's start on the out-breath. Now you can see that just little stupid things like this is innovating. Let's make it a bit more fun, a bit more interesting. And if you really want to make it interesting, you can do the three in-breaths to one out-breath meditation. So just going in, out, in, out, go in, in, in. So what we do is... Now you see it's made you laugh. The reason it's made you laugh, because it's fun, it's interesting. Where does your boredom go when you laugh? It just goes out the windows. If we had any windows in this room, that was. But what happens is that that makes things interesting. You're getting out of this boredom which comes from habitually doing the same thing in the same way, hour after hour after hour. So you do make it interesting for yourself. You don't always sit in the same place, or even the same way. You can actually sit backwards, sit the other way around and face that direction, or whatever. What that's actually doing psychologically is giving you some variety, and that variety sort of makes the mind alive. Go and sit in the stupa. In the time of the Buddha, there was, no, not time of the Buddha, of our tradition, there was one of these monks, and he was just so sleepy, and he would never be able to meditate without sort of drooping. So this was Ajahn Mun, took him for a walk in the forest, and he came across this cliff with a 100-meter drop. And because in those days you had to do what your teacher said, he put this monk on the edge of that drop and said, "You're going to meditate here all night." And the monk looked down. He knew he was sleepy. He knew that if he just nodded a little bit, he'd tumble over the cliff and kill himself. But he had so much faith to your teacher, he said, "Well, I'm going to have to do this now." And he was prepared to die. He thought he wouldn't survive the night. All night, sooner or later, you'll topple over, and that meant over the cliff and to certain death. But of course, the reason he told that story, maybe other monks tried that and they never lived to tell the tale. But this was the one of the survivors. this monk said, yeah, you know, he was very scared, and that made him very awake. And so he got into this really wonderful state of meditation. And perfectly alert, perfectly sort of stable, and when he opened his eyes it was dawn. Time to go an arms round. But he thought, wow, this is so nice, I don't want to go an arms round today. So he closed his eyes and carried on meditating. So that's what happens when you have a lot of joy. You don't think about food. Food you can eat another day. So the meditation's more fun. So we haven't got a cliff here, but you've got that little stupa. And if you fall over, it's only grass, you're not going to do too much damage to yourself. So maybe if you're really sleepy in the morning, just go and sit on the edge of the stupa and see what happens. But that's one way of dealing with it. But it's not really the recommended way. The recommended way is just making peace. Because I used to suffer from lots and lots of stuff and torpor when I was a young monk. I look back upon that time now and I realise it's all cause and effect. It wasn't I was a dull person. It was because I was malnourished. I used to get terrible food. I was just saying this morning, when I had a choice of jams, I could have apricot jam, scotch marmalade, or fruits of the forest. And I was mad, I don't fancy the apricot jam. What do you mean you don't fancy the apricot jam? You used to eat frogs and snails when you were a young monk. What's wrong with apricot jam? Yeah, compared to frogs and snails, apricot jam is heavenly fruit. But I started reminiscing about the worst of the food was actually the snails. Because the snails, they were literally like eating an eraser. They were just so rubbery, it's just so hard actually to chew into them. Let alone what they tasted like. So really gross things to eat, and I don't know how I ever did that. But I was malnourished. So I was really thin in those days. Sometimes you see some of these pictures of the monks in those days, actually, that in 1974, I think it was, I think just the year I came there, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip actually visited Thailand. And the Thai authorities, they were very proud of their Western monks. So they arranged all the senior Western monks, I wasn't there at the time, I was too junior, all the senior Western monks, they go to this royal monastery in Bangkok, in Wat Pawan, they're going to have an audience with Prince Philip. And so they had the audience. And afterwards, the Prince Philip, the consort of Queen Elizabeth, remarked to the press, "I've never seen such a thin and anemic group of young men in my life." Because they were like bean poles. They had no flesh on them and they looked very weak. Mostly it's because they couldn't take the food in those days. It's quite understandable. And I was a bean pole too. So I was malnourished. We'd go to bed maybe 10, earliest 10 o'clock, maybe 11 o'clock. We'd get up at 3. And that was it, just four and a half hours sleep at night. So, you were sleep deprived, really big time sleep deprived. And you were in this climate which was just so hot and sticky, no air cons or fans, no electricity in that monastery. So what would you do? What would anyone do? You get up at 3 o'clock in the morning in a climate you weren't used to, with malnourished and tired. You were sleepy. It was nature. When I saw the causes and effects, everyone, even the Buddha would, if he was born in London and sort of went over there, would be sleepy. So I realized it was just cause and effect. But at that time, I used to fight my sloth and torpor. Because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. You're sleepy. Come on, get your act together. Use willpower. And one thing I found, that willpower never worked. You could break through the sloth and torpor, yeah. But then you'd start being very, very restless. You couldn't stop the mind. And as soon as you try to make the mind peaceful, you fall asleep again. There was a pendulum between those two hindrances, restlessness and sloth and torpor. And you could never find that middle point. That's just that beautiful, awake peacefulness. Now I know my mistake. It was fighting. Remember, sloth and torpor is not having much energy, and that's much mental energy. And if you use whatever remnant of mental energy you have to fight that state, you're wasting energy. Instead, you make peace with it. You're gentle, you allow it to be. You're kind, you open the door of your heart with unconditional mindfulness. Unconditional means you don't judge it. It's not bad, it's not good, it's just nature. You let it be. You're kind to it with unconditional loving kindness. And then, because you're not fighting it, as I mentioned earlier, all the energy you have can go into mindfulness. It's not wasted by making a battle. And it's such a short time, the energy starts to go back into mindfulness. The sloth and torpor starts to clear like the mist in an early morning. And when it does clear, you've got no sloth and torpor, you're alert, but you're at peace. Now I never fight sloth and torpor. I notice it with as much mindfulness as I can. You don't have much mindfulness when you're sleepy, but at least I know I can recognize it. And I just make peace with it. I leave it alone. I never fight it. And that way it goes very quickly. And when it goes, you're really, really peaceful. That's the way to overcome sloth and torpor. Not by fighting. The same with restlessness. What is restlessness anyway? Just the mind being agitated. You can't grab hold of that mind and say, stop. Imagine you have a child, or you're looking after a child, maybe a grandchild, and they can't go to sleep at night because they're restless. Maybe they've been watching too many videos or playing too many computer games, and they're really sort of wired. If you go into their room, imagine you do this, you look at them, you grab them by the throat, get to bed or you'll be in big trouble. Go to sleep, shut up, be quiet. Now would that make the person relax and go to sleep? If we sometimes we do that to ourselves. You've got a restless mind. Come on, mind. Get your act together. Be still. Watch the breath. Or else you're in big trouble, mind, if you don't watch the breath. I've had enough of you. If you do things like that, you find it just makes the mind more agitated. So a lot of times when people experience restlessness, they use force to try and stop it, and it just gets worse. So instead, again, you just make peace with that restlessness. By making peace with it, it is the old simile again, you've got water which is agitated, you put it down. It takes time, but because you're not agitating your mind further, you're not contributing to the waves of restlessness in the lake which is your mind. Those waves get less and less and less. until the restlessness goes. You're patient, you don't interfere, you just make peace, be kind, be gentle, and restlessness vanishes by itself. As Ajahn Chah used to say, he didn't use a bottle of water, he used his hand. He would wave it up and down. He wasn't saying goodbye, he was just saying, this is like a leaf on a tree when the wind is blowing. But it only blows because of the wind. It's not the natural state of the leaf, it's just because of the wind, that's all. Just like your mind, it may be restless, going backwards and forwards. It's not the natural state of the mind, it's just because of the winds of craving. If you stop those winds of craving, then the leaf still moves up and down, but less and less and less, until it comes to a perfect stop, because there's no more wind. So he said that's what happens with restlessness. You take away the craving, and then the leaf stops, the mind becomes still. That's how we overcome the restless mind. And the classic story, my favorite story, is the Buddha with Ananda passing in the forest, and he passes two monks. I think I told this on the first night, but nevertheless, here it comes again. One monk, perfectly straight, like some of you. You come in the early morning, you're perfectly straight. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda, I'm worried about that yogi. Well, he actually wasn't a yogi, he was a monk. I'm worried about that monk. And of course, Ananda didn't understand why, because he's perfect posture. You know, he's putting forth effort. He's meditating. He must be a great monk. No. 2 weeks later, he disrobed and got married. And the other monk was very, lots of strop and torpor, nodding all over the place. Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. Not worried about that guy at all. A couple of weeks later, fully enlightened with psychic powers. Great story. First monk was controlling, putting forth that desire effort. And the other monk was just letting things be and allowing the nature of sleepiness to dissipate through the power of peace. And that's how we overcome hindrances. Be careful. However, you got also the doubt. You may doubt these methods, but the only way to find out is to try them. You've got a lot of success. People keep coming here, not because they can't meditate and they have to come again for a refresher course. It's because they're getting something out of this method of meditation. They are getting jhanas, they are getting deep states. So it's actually working. That's actually why we got the money to build this place, because people have found it works. They want this method to actually have a physical place where it can be taught. So it does work, which is where you overcome doubt. Doubt can only be overcome really through experience. Yeah, you can have faith in the teacher, but which teacher are you going to have faith in? There's so many different teachers and they teach different things. The only real teacher you will ever have is your own experience. Remember, that's your big ajahn, your big teacher, the experience which you get in your own meditation. So when you get experience and you find out these things work, it does overcome your doubt. The doubt can be lessened by checking out what the Buddha actually said and finding out that, you know, what I said here, you got very clear confirmation in the suttas. So that really helps, but most of doubt comes by your own experience, giving it a try and seeing if it works. But sometimes in a meditation retreat, people get what we call the attack of all the hindrances. The first time I heard about this was in the interview, and one time someone came, all day, it's not just one hindrance, all five all together have been attacking me. I don't know how that could be. I don't know how it could be sloth and torpor and restlessness at the same time. But I've got to believe what they say. All the five hindrances, I'm going crazy. And so that is where you developed what I called in my book the Nalagiri strategy. And this is a very good way of overcoming intense hindrances. Because on a 9-day retreat, there'll be some days, some afternoons or mornings, you've just had it. This is just too much, and you just want to sort of make a run for the door. If you have the attack of all the hindrances, remember the story of the Buddha at Nalagiri, the elephant. where one of the Buddha's enemies intoxicated this big elephant and set the elephant free along the narrow roads of Rajagaha when the Buddha was coming on alms round. So these were narrow streets. And some of you have been to India, the old parts of India, and the old towns, really, really narrow alleyways, really. And the Buddha was walking on alms round with his monks, and in the opposite direction, this elephant was charging, destroying and crashing into everything in his way. And so the people were running away, and they ran and saw the monks and said, "Get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming in this direction, run!" And all the monks, actually in the Melinda Panha, the king asked, King Melinda asked Nagasena, these were supposed to be arahats. Why did these monks following the Buddha climb up trees and jump over walls? And in the Melinda Panha, Nagasena was, because the monks knew what was going to happen and they wanted to get out of the way to allow the Buddha to show the great power of wisdom. So being doctors didn't start with Tony Blair. Monks knew how to spin the truth a long time before then. Look at the Melinda Panha and you'll see that. But anyhow, so the monks all ran away except for Ananda. And Ananda, you can get an idea of the characters in the time of the Buddha. This was this beautiful monk who had sacrificed anything for his teacher. He loved his teacher. And he had this amazing, amazing episode of heroism. He went and stood in front of his teacher with his arms out. "Let the elephant attack me and kill me so I can protect my teacher, the Lord Buddha." That was really devotion. That was really such a sacrifice. "Would you do that to me if I was..." "You'd be up a tree as well." But there was Ananda in front of his teacher. And the Buddha, "Out of the way, Ananda, I can handle this." "It's very sweet of you to do something like that." So poor Ananda couldn't show his heroism. He was actually pushed out of the way. It reminded me of a story of one of the monks I grew up with. He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. And his helicopter was shot down by the Viet Cong. That was really dangerous, because many of the helicopter pilots got captured and tortured and goodness knows what else. So he was shot down. And he said he had this moment of heroism. He thought he was like John Wayne. He actually jumped up on top of the helicopter bubble, got out his grenades. "Yeah, let them come, let them come." And as soon as he did that, he fell through the perspex of the helicopter. It's one moment of true heroism, and he made a mess of it. Fortunately, another helicopter came to save him afterwards, but he said it was one of the most embarrassing moments of his life. But anyway, it's back to Ananda. They pushed Ananda out of the way. And there was this great battle. And this is very symbolic between this powerful, mad energy of an intoxicated elephant, which could crush anything, and this frail, peaceful, compassionate being called a Buddha. What would win? Force or kindness? Now, you should all know, if you've read any of the suttas, the Buddha had immense psychic powers. Even though this is not said, that Buddha could have grabbed this elephant by the trunk, swirled him 3 times around his head, and thrown him over the Ganges River about 300 kilometers away. That would be easy. But that's not how the Buddha behaves towards someone trying to kill him. He doesn't use force to stop force. And you all know what the Buddha did next. He spread this metta, this compassion towards this elephant. In a way I describe metta, he would have thought something similar to Naragiri. "The door of my heart is open to you, no matter what you do to me. You can crush me under your powerful feet. You can pick up my body with your trunk and smash me against the tree or a house or a wall. whatever you do to me, I will always be your friend. I will always give you my unbounded love, compassion and kindness. That's what we mean by metta. And what happens when this powerful force of a mad elephant meets compassion, real compassion, opening the door of your heart totally to whatever's going to happen? In a second or two, that elephant had stopped right in front of the Buddha with his head down and the Buddha stroking his trunk gently. There, Narakiri. There, Narakiri. There, Narakiri. And that's how the Buddha subdued the mad, crazy elephant. The Narakiri statue is very similar. Sometimes your mind is like mad, intoxicated, crazy, destroying everything in its path, sending you up the wall. So what do? Don't fight it with force. Instead, mind, however crazy and violent you are, the door of my heart is open to you. You can do whatever you want to me, but I'll always love you and care for you. You can crush me under psychosis. You can send me to the hospital. You can make me the most crazy person and destroy everything in me. But mind, I will still love and care for you. If you do that, in a second or two, your crazy mind will be bound to walk in front of you. And you'll be stroking you. There, mind. There, mind. There, mind. So Narakiri strategy, and it works. Simply because the power of kindness, the power of letting go, the power of letting things be, that is far more powerful than any sort of craziness, will, force or whatever. That's how you overcome hindrances. That's why I love that story, because it has a huge powerful problem and a beautiful solution. And of course that elephant will be devoted to you forever after that. Will do anything for you. As you see happens if you save an animal's life or care for a being in great distress. They've got so much gratitude, infinite gratitude, they'll do whatever you want for that time on. That's how you train the mind. Not with will, but with this beautiful wisdom, especially with kindness. So this is how the hindrances are overcome. Very simple. Once you know how to do it, you realize your big mistakes. Stupid, I was fighting my mind. Stupid, I was trying to sort of force a mind. I was just feeding the willpower. I was just feeding the restlessness. I was just prolonging sloth and torpor by fighting it. I had no kindness, and the Buddha was supposed to be a compassionate one. Was I really a Buddhist after all? So remember, this is one package, this Buddhism. Meditation isn't one thing and the Dharma another thing. It all melds together. Even just already mentioned second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. Second noble truth is when you try and get something, craving, and you're suffering. And if you're having a peaceful time, the meditation is working, you're enjoying yourself. It must be because you've stopped craving, you've let go of craving. I did want to mention, and this is a fascinating part of the third noble truth, what I've called these days the four ways of letting go. It's right there in the suttas, but few people actually notice it. You say letting go, and people ask me, what is letting go? What are you supposed to let go of? And how do you let go? Every person knows that letting go is important, but it's such a difficult thing to do. Here in the first sutta of the Buddha, the Dhammacakka Sutta, in the standard explanation of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha gives you four different ways of letting go. And those four ways are chaga, giving, patinisaga, which is throwing things away, mutti, which is freedom, and analia, which is, I've called, having a Teflon mind. And the first one, chaga, means just giving. Real giving, though. Many of you have given huge donations to this retreat center, but have you seen any signs on the walls that this brick was given by sort of Rodney, or this door was given by Cheng, or this light was given by Chaupo. You don't see any signs here, because when you give, you don't expect anything back in return. If you give and expect to have a sign put on the wall of the retreat center, that's not giving. That's called advertising. That's why we don't do that in forest monasteries. You don't see that this gate was given by so-and-so and their family. Because that's just advertising, it's not real giving. Real giving is expecting nothing back in return. Not even a receipt or a tax receipt to claim back on your tax. But people do that, we don't mind that. But real giving is giving expecting nothing back in return. Now you understand why giving is part of letting go. The next time you meditate, give the hour as your gift to the Buddha, expecting nothing back in return. You don't expect jhana, you don't even expect to be peaceful. This is your donation to the great teacher, to the Buddha, or to the Triple Gem, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I give this hour to the Triple Gem, but I don't expect anything back in return. Now that is real giving. And if you do that, you'll have a beautiful meditation. Because the expectations and the wanting and desires stop the mind becoming peaceful. Giving your mind to the breath in this moment. You don't expect to get progress in meditation. You don't expect to get great insights. Because that's not giving, that's doing business again. Meditation is not spiritual business. We're not doing this to get something, as Ajahn Chah kept on saying. We do this to abandon things, to let go of things. So we give our mind to this moment, we give our mind to this breath, we give everything to this meditation, and we don't expect anything back. Because expectations is one of the biggest hindrances. It's a part of desire which stop you attaining. I don't know how many of you here have had good meditations and can't get them back again. That's one of the most frustrating things. You have beautiful nimittas, you have even jhanas. Oh, this is great, I can meditate now. And you can't do it again. And why is it? Number one enemy, expectations. You're trying to get peaceful, it's happening, it's going to happen, and you've blown it. So because you want something, you expect something. And sometimes people come here and say, Ajahn Brahm teaches jhanas. I'm going to go here for 9 days, I'm going to get everything. I'm going to get jhanas, I expect jhanas. If I don't get jhanas, I'm going to demand my money back. That's one of the reasons we decided not to charge. So you can't ask for your money back. You never gave any to start with. So I'm safe. So you're giving, expecting nothing at all back in return. That's the first part of letting go. No expectations, which is what giving is part of. The second way is patinisika, is throwing things out. And I gave the simile of this hot air balloon. You go in a hot air balloon, you go really high, but you can't go any higher. Just like in meditation, you're getting really peaceful, you just can't go any higher. You must be carrying something. You're carrying something in the basket of your balloon, which stops you going higher. So if you're in a hot air balloon, you look in your basket, what have I got there which I can throw out? Sandwiches? Yeah, they can go out. No, my flask of tea? Okay, out you go. Throw everything out. And once you throw something out, you go higher. It's the same way that when you're meditating, you know, you get so far, you can't go deeper, you're holding on to something. It could be a craving, it could be a desire. There's something in there which you're not letting go of. See it? Throw it away. And you go higher. And you go so high. And you can't go any higher. And you look in your basket, there's nothing there to throw out. You think, this is when you get to very deep states of meditation. You haven't got the nimittas yet. But you know, you're close to nimittas. You just can't get into the nimittas. Or you see the nimitta and it disappears again. I must be holding on to something. What can I throw out? And that's when you realize the basket.
So you untie the basket and you throw that out and you're holding onto the ropes of the balloon. In this simile, the basket is your body. Your body literally is a basket case. As you all know. So you really let go of your body. That's one of the things which we don't let go of. So you see then you throw it out, so the body whole disappears, you get into nimittas. But you can't get into the jhanas. Why? You've got nothing else to let go of. You're just holding on to the balloon. How can I get from the nimittas into jhana? Ah, you. You have to throw you off. So you throw yourself off the balloon, and then the balloon goes into jhanas without you, without a self. Your will! You have to disappear. So in each stage we're throwing something out, we're throwing something out, we're throwing something out to get really, really high. That's the other way of letting go. Throwing things away, 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 till there's nothing left. And you think there's nothing left, but yeah, there's a few things you can still throw out yet. Things which are not really quite clear of whether you should throw out or not. Things like your body or your will. But you've got to do that. See how much you can throw away. And that's the second type of letting go. The third type of letting go is my favourite. And that is the story of the monk who would go to teach in prison. After teaching many weeks in the prison, they invited him to stay behind for tea. Then they asked him about what life was like in our monastery just over the road. When he told them what time we get up and how we eat and how hard we work, and there's no TV, there's no radio, there's no sex, there's no sport, there's no playing cards, there's meditation. They were just so upset at how ascetic a monastery is. And our monastery is austere. I sleep on the floor. Actually, the bed I've got here, this is luxury, these beds over here. I've got one of these folder beds, it's so luxurious. But over the monastery I sleep on the floor. And when they heard how ascetic a monastery was, and because they liked this monk, and because in a prison you do have TVs, you do have three or four meals a day, you don't have to throw it all in the same bowl. You've got actually a tray with, you know, this is for the potatoes or the rice, this is for this curry, this is for that sauce, this is for the sweet. And sometimes it gets all thrown in the same bowl in the monastery. And when they compared the comforts of a modern day prison in Australia to the austerity of a modern day monastery, they were so upset that their friend was doing it so tough that one of them said, verbatim, "It's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" They invited the monk to come into jail for greater comfort. And when they realised what they said, they burst out laughing. And the monk told me when he came back to the monastery, and we laughed too. But there was something about that story which really hit me. And I thought about it, and why is it? It's true. In a Buddhist monastery it's much more austere. Even in this, well, maybe this place is pretty comfortable. In many retreats which you go to, it's far more austere than a prison in Australia. So why is it that people want to escape from prison? Why is it that people want to join monasteries? It's nothing about the austerity or the external conditions. The only difference is, in a prison people don't want to be there. In a monastery people want to be there. It's whether you want to be there or not. And from that realization insight, you understood that any place you don't want to be is a prison, in the deepest meaning of that word. Any place you don't want to be is your prison. If you're sitting meditating, you just don't want to be here, you're hanging out for lunch, this hall here becomes your prison. If you're in this retreat center and you can't wait to go home, the retreat center is your jail. If you're in a body which is aching, you don't like it, your body is a prison. If you're with a crazy family, which you've been born into, and it's very hard to escape from a family, and they're driving you crazy, if you don't want to be with them, you've just made another prison for yourself. And How do you escape from the prisons of life? Not through willpower. You don't escape from this prison called Jhana Grove Correction Center by just driving out through the gates. You don't sort of escape from your body by drinking alcohol or taking drugs. Nor do you escape from your family problems by just avoiding them. The only way we can escape is changing our attitude to want to be here. It's amazing, if you want to be here, wherever that is, you feel totally free. If you're waiting for your plane and it's late, if you don't want to be in the airport is like a prison. If you're just happy to be there, you feel free. If ever I get sent to jail, it'll be wonderful. I'll have all this time to meditate. I won't have to go and give talks anywhere. People won't be sending me letters asking me to comment about the fact that monks in Singapore are on trial. I won't have to do anything. I can just sit there and I'll have 3 meals a day, even the TV to watch. Oh, if I go to prison, it will be heaven for a monk. And even if I get really fed up, I'll just break some rule and get solitary confinement. That'll be a retreat. Just give me an extra couple of months in solitary. That would be the best of all. The point is that if you are happy to be there, you'll be free. Now that's a very powerful point in how to let go. When you're tired and sleepy, do you want to be somewhere else? If you're upset at your sloth and torpor, you put a prison around yourself. If you're restless and want to be somewhere else, again you're in prison. If you're just in one state of meditation and you don't want to be there, you want to be in another state of meditation. You're in nimittas and you want jhana. Nimitta becomes a prison for you. It's nothing to do with what you're experiencing but how you're experiencing it. If you want to be here with this crazy mind, with this brilliant mind, with this tired mind, with this energetic mind, if you just want to be here, you're free. That's the first way of letting go. Wanting to be here. No craving. No ill will. Being so content to be where you happen to be. And it doesn't need to be the perfect place. It doesn't need to be nimittas or jhanas or full enlightenment. Just be happy to be stupid. And then you're not stupid anymore. Be happy to be here. Be content. That's why in meditation, if you want a mantra, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. That comes from the Thai, Paw Di. Paw, breathing in, Paw Di. Paw Di. Be content. You can do that, you've let go. Just being happy to be here. And the last way, the Teflon mind. The Teflon mind, I call it Analya, a place where nothing sticks. When nothing holds on to you and you don't hold on to it. So a thought like a cough comes through the room and it goes in one ear and out the other. You don't think we're going to have health checks from the next retreat. You know in Singapore when they had the SARS crisis, they had these like infrared cameras and they could actually check you at the airport to see if you had a fever. And if you had a fever they would put you in quarantine, they wouldn't let you in the country. So maybe we can do that on the next retreat, have the infrared cameras. And anyone who's sick has got a fever, they can't come in. So only get the healthy people on this retreat. We have to give a medical beforehand. And any coughs, any sneezing, that's it, back to Penang with you. Of course, that's really stupid. So instead someone coughs and that's it, it's gone completely. We don't think about it. Why did they cough? They shouldn't have coughed. We shouldn't do this. That's what Ajahn Chah called disturbing the noise, or disturbing the sound. The sound, it comes and goes very quickly. So have a Teflon mind. Whatever's just happened vanishes immediately. Good meditation, bad meditation, it's gone. Nothing sticks to your mind. It's amazing how much stuff sticks to you. And how sort of most of the stuff which sticks to you is the shit. About the wrong things which happened, the bad things which happened, the phone call yesterday, or the disappointment you had, or the bad meditation you had last week, or the terrible food, or this or that. So much bad stuff sticks to our mind. We haven't got a Teflon mind. No wonder our mind is dirty and so sore with so much bad stuff. Even good stuff we should let go of, let alone the bad stuff. So having a Teflon mind is allowing the past to completely vanish as soon as it's gone. Sounds vanish as soon as it's gone. That sounds obvious. But for many people it doesn't vanish as soon as it's gone. It lingers there once it's gone. So having a Teflon mind is nothing sticks to you. Another way of being free. These are the four ways of letting go. Giving, expecting nothing back in return. Giving your mind to this moment of meditation. Giving your time and energy to this retreat. Not expecting anything back at all. And throwing as much away as you can when you're meditating. Throw away your family. Throw away your past. Throw away your future. Throw away all your expectations. Throw away your past and all your experience you've had so far. Throw everything away. And eventually throw away your body. Throw away your will. Chuck everything out. That's throwing things away. And the third is just being content to be here. Not wanting to be anywhere else, no matter what you experience. Even the most painful, austere condition. If you're happy to be here, you feel this incredible state of freedom. What I said is a freedom from desires. And lastly, just allow nothing to stick. You don't have to remember the talks, because they're in the mind anyway. It's already gone into your subconscious. You don't have to try to remember anything. Memory is a natural phenomenon which actually works much better when you don't try. You relax and you remember. You try and then you forget. So you just have a Teflon mind. It's nothing sticks and you're free. Four ways of letting go. Chaga, Pati, Nisaga, Muti, Analia. The Buddha's explanation of the Third Noble Truth. Standard Dhamma, but very powerful when you meditate. And it stops so many hindrances, so many problems. And you know the problems have to be stopped because you're not experiencing suffering anymore. You've let go of something. If you are experiencing suffering, you haven't let go yet. So try the antidote to a hindrance of suffering in meditation. Having a hard time? Check those four. Are you really giving, expecting nothing back? Are you really throwing things away or trying to accumulate more things? Are you content where you are, or do you want to be somewhere else? And are you carrying baggage with a mind to which so many things stick, which are none of your business? Check it out. And you'll find the hindrances will vanish. You'll be free. Be into jhanas, enlightened, and having a wonderful time when you don't want it. So that's the talk today about overcoming the hindrances, part two. Very good. So have a nice morning. 2 hours of bliss. Until you have to be disturbed by that terrible, yucky lunch. So enjoy your meditation.